Hello, everybody. This is Craig D. Lindsay, a.k.a. Uncle Krizzle, a.k.a. Black Larry David, a.k.a. Cranky Charlie Rose, a.k.a. Anastasia Beaverhausen, a.k.a. Captain Anadonia. And welcome to another jubilant edition. Yeah, let's go with jubilant of Motherfuckers I Know, the podcast where I talk to motherfuckers I know. Because, hey, I got problems. And sometimes I need to talk to motherfuckers about that. And for today's episode, I'm calling up somebody all the way from up in Brooklyn. He is a film critic, big surprise. But he's also a illustrator and a book reviewer, I believe. And just does a lot of wonderful things. And his name is Nathan Gielgud. Welcome to the Krizzlecast, sir. Is it Gielgud or is Gielgud, right?
Gielgud, yeah, you got it. Like smell good.
All right, yeah, all right. That's a good way to remember it. It's Gielgud, right. Smell good. All right. Okay. Before we started talking, we started doing this episode. You emailed me and said you're gonna be a little bit late because you were renting a copy of Desperately Seeking Susan on DVD.
Yeah, so I'm doing this illustrated piece about John Turturro, and I wanted to do something about his, like, there's three movies that he's got small roles in like 85 and 86. Mm-hmm. So the idea of the illustrated essay is like, that most people know film work from the Coen brothers and from Spike Lee, but there's this little pocket of movies that happen to be back-to-back-to-back that he's in, Desperately Seeking Susan, Hannah and Her Sisters, To Live and Die in L.A.
Oh, yeah, I remember seeing him in To Live and Die in L.A. I don't remember him much from Desperately Seeking Susan, but I haven't seen that movie since I was, like, 9 or 10, so I don't remember much about it. But, I mean, where did that...
Susan's great. It's a movie that came to kind of late. A few years ago, it was on, like, TV, and I had never seen it before, and I didn't watch it. I didn't, like, sit down and watch it. I was either falling asleep and waking up, or maybe I was changing the channel and going back. But it's really dreamy and weird. Especially if you're not watching it straight through. Mm-hmm. It reminded me a lot of the Rivette movie, Celine and Julie Go Boating. And so I got really interested in it, and then a few months later I sat down and watched it, and it is a lot like Celine and Julie Go Boating. And then I found out later that that movie was a big influence on that movie, but when now I need to do this Turturro thing, and I don't really remember what Turturro does in it either, except that he works in the Magic Club. So yeah. After we get off the phone, I'll look for his scenes on that DVD.
Well, how did that project come along?
I do a lot of illustration work for the Brooklyn Academy of Music, where I also work there too. And Turturro is going to be in a play, The Master Builder, a Henrik Ibsen play, at BAM. And so I do illustrated blog posts for them sometimes about upcoming stuff. And they're pretty cool about letting me just do whatever I want as long as it's kind of related to something going on. Yeah. So I thought that would be any reason to watch Desperately Seeking Susan again, I jump on it.
Yeah. And I believe you did this very cool thing I saw over on your website, which they had a retrospective on Max von Sydow. And did you do the cover for the brochure?
We did like this. We did this on one side of the poster, and then you unfold it, and on the other side is the schedule for the retrospective. And so we took. So the image we did is just a silhouette of him in The Exorcist, which is, like the poster for The Exorcist is the house with the streetlight and him. And so, out, you know?
Yeah.
Like, if it's just an obvious choice. Like, there's a few obvious choices with him, right? Like, The Exorcist, Seventh Seal.
But that's I found it to be such a captivating graphic, you know, just an illustration, because it just, I mean, you could basically, I mean, you say that, I mean, it's just a silhouette of him. I mean, there's not really anything that draws upon, or whether, you know, The Exorcist, I mean, it doesn't have him, you know, in front of the house or anything, just him and the silhouette, and you can, and in a way, just like, that could be sum up, like, most of the performances that Max von Sydow has done. I mean, it's like, just like this, he is this, you know, certainly every time I see him in a movie, whether it is The Exorcist, or even something like Hannah and Her Sisters, where he played, Barbara Hershey's, boyfriend, just, he is this ominous figure, this mysterious person that just shows up in a film, and just have a presence all his own, and just like that image kind of capture that.
Yeah, when I was trying to think of what ideas to pitch for that poster, I was realizing that his career kind of breaks up in a kind of neat way, where there's like the European movies, you know, of course, like especially Bergman, and then there's some movies where he's sort of like playing this idea of himself, like in Hannah and Her Sisters, where, like, you know, like Woody Allen as you know, Woody Allen's such a Bergman fan, and so, like, any excuse to get him in his movie,
yeah,
I'm sure he was jumping on it, and I'm sure, you know, he kind of, like, well, I mean, Woody Allen does that anyway, he just sits back and let people kind of do whatever they're going to do, apparently. But then there's this other phase of him, which is where he plays these sort of cartoonish bad guys.
Yeah, like, I don't know if you ever saw him in the movie Needful Things, where I believe he played the devil, if I'm correct on that.
No, I haven't seen that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, but there's the Bond movie, yeah. And there's, he's in, like, Strange Brew.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah, I remember, yeah, Strange Brew.
Yeah. So I wanted, my first idea was to kind of do something that played with that idea, mm-hmm, of these three kind of faces of him, but it just got too complicated, and so I'm glad that you say that the silhouette really works for you. It's cool that you say that it kind of sums up his persona or the way that he shows up in movies.
Mm-hmm. Well, the thing about it is just like in picking up a lot more things about you, because I mean, this is kind of what I know about you from the jump. You started when you first started appearing on my radar was when David Fellerath over the Independent Weekly here in the Raleigh-Durham area started using you to write reviews of movies that, you know, just because you were in New York, and of course, since you're in New York, you have more access to films, because that mainly because Godfrey Cheshire used to write about movies from New York, but he moved on. So basically, David needed another New York guy, and you originally freelanced for the Independent, I believe, when you was here in the state, when you were going to school, I believe, studying film in the University of North Carolina. So I mean, is both of that correct? What?
I was at, yeah, you got it pretty much right. I was at State,
State?
Shortly after I left State, I stayed in Raleigh, and that's when I started writing for The Independent.
Mm-hmm.
And me and David were kind of doing the same thing. Like, we were both just trying to get whatever word, you know, get a byline whenever we could.
Mm-hmm.
So I would do occasional movie reviews, but they put me on, like, this gallery beat where I was writing about, like, gallery shows,
mm-hmm,
which was kind of fun. I didn't really have a background in that stuff, but, you know, I just wanted to write. So, yeah, you're right. That was how I started, and then I moved to New York 11 years ago. But, yeah, like you said, when Godfrey left, David got in touch with me and asked me if I would be interested in starting to contribute again.
Yeah, and when here, and I mean, I'm trying to see if you were originally from North Carolina, or you're from somewhere else, and when did you, if you are from somewhere else, when did you come down here to NC?
I was born in upstate New York, mm-hmm. And then my family moved down to Charlotte when I was a little kid, and that's where I grew up, and then I went to school at State starting in, it must have been 96, mm-hmm. Or 97 maybe.
Nice. And when you
graduated? And then I was there until I moved up here.
Okay, when you graduated from State?
2000.
2000, okay, yeah. And, yeah. Okay, so you were studying film in State, right?
Yeah, I didn't know I was going to study movies. But I was like, I did a mid-year transfer to State. I started somewhere else. And I was just, this is back when you had to register for classes over the phone.
Okay.
You're sitting there with the catalog and you're just trying to find stuff to enroll in, and I was like really late on the jump. And there was this intro to film course that was still available. And by luck of the draw, Joe Gomez was teaching intro to film that year, which it might have been the last year that he taught intro.
Mm-hmm.
And just like two or three classes with Joe Gomez, and I was hooked.
You just hooked into studying that. Well, I mean, what was originally your, like, was it, you originally have a major, or is it just like you were just looking for stuff?
I was going to be an English major. I wanted to be a writer. I still studied. You know, I got an English minor.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, as soon as I started taking film courses, I wanted to figure out how to do more and more of that.
I mean, what hooked you about film and? Because obviously it kind of led you to write about film and even do illustrations about film.
I mean, that's kind of a question. I know that, when I was in high school, I watched Hannah and Her Sisters again, mm-hmm. With my dad, and there's a scene where Woody Allen is, like, he's, like, kind of soul-searching, looking for a new religion.
Oh yeah,
and he's talking to a Hare Krishna. I don't know what park it's at, but it might be Central Park. But he's talking to a Hare Krishna who hands him literature like over a fence. Like he's talking to him through like a chain link fence.
Yeah,
and the Hare Krishna gives him some brochures, and the Hare Krishna walks back away from the camera, deep into the frame, and then Woody walks to the left, and the camera follows him, and there's this fence separating him from this group of Hare Krishnas, and I remember my dad going like, that fence, that's a good touch. And I didn't know exactly, I couldn't explain why the fence was such a good touch, but like, I knew he was onto something.
Yeah.
And then when I started taking film classes with Joe, I was getting more into it, it was great. It was sort of the explanation for those kinds of things started to come in, and it was like, scratching an itch that I didn't really know was there. Like, it wasn't like I was trying to figure out the fence the whole time, but, like, there was something about watching movies that started to be explained to me,
yeah.
In those classes.
Well, I mean, did you ever talk to your dad about the fence? Because he might have just been saying, hey, he is a good touch to add that fence, so, you know, he wouldn't be around all those Hare Krishnas or anything like that.
like keeping him away from him?
Yeah.
I don't know. Mention it. I don't want to. It's double sided, right? Like I want to bring it up to give my dad credit, but then I don't want to bring it up to shatter. If I shatter the illusion in the way that he meant it, was much more literal.
Yeah, because you kind of, from where you say it, you kind of that was the kind of thing that kind of set your whole idea of wanting to do more about film off, and then when you find out that that wasn't what I meant, it can just be kind of
right.
Disappointing. But, you know, just...
No, it's good. I mean, maybe it would be even better if that's not what he meant, you know? Because
yeah.
That's sort of the openness of interpretation is what's so exciting. Anyway.
Well, I mean, let's talk real briefly about the family. I mean, what's the family makeup like?
It's just, me and my parents, I don't have any brothers.
Yeah, I mean, you're just an only child?
Yeah, my mom's an editor at the Charlotte Observer. So I actually worked in, I was a copy editor there when I was in high school. I think my first job was at a sandwich counter, but my second job was at a copy editor, so my second job was in journalism.
Wait, so you...
Sort of.
How old were you when this happened?
I was probably 17 or 18. I definitely did it in high school, and then I would do it at least one or two summers during college.
Like, you were a actually on the copy desk, you had a paycheck and everything, it wasn't an intern gig or anything?
No, it was a real job. It was, this was when they had to, like, there was much more paper moving around. I'm sure that there's much less, you know, I'm sure that everything's just with computers now, but this is when they had to pass around, like, layout sheets and things like that. So, I would, you know, every writer and every editor had a basket, like a wire basket on top of his desk.
Yeah.
I mean, on top of his or her computer, and would put papers in there for us to just come grab and take wherever they were supposed to go. And sometimes you'd roll them up and put them in those pneumatic tubes and drop them in a tube and it would go off. God knows where.
Yeah, wow, man. So you did that for a couple of summers, you say?
Yeah, I just a little bit. It's always totaled a few months, but you know, when you're younger, those few months feel a lot bigger.
Yeah. And so I guess that, you know, obviously that's where you caught the whole writing bug and all that stuff.
Yeah, probably. Newsroom's kind of a romantic place, you know. It's like, you know, like a hive of people figuring things out.
Yeah.
And there's like a result every night, you know? Like the Saturday night shifts I used to work, which was really cool, because that was when the Sunday paper, they were working on the Sunday paper. And I'd be the first guy to go down to the print room and grab the Sunday paper, and I'd grab a bunch of stacks of them. Sometimes I'd wait for the first ones to be run off, and I'd put them on my cart, and then wheel them back up, and then pass them off to all the editors, and they'd have to go, they'd do a quick leaf through the paper, and if everything's okay, they'd cut me loose and tell me, go home, kid.
Yeah. Of course,
so kind of like, you know, it feels like a really classic sort of environment.
Yeah. Well, it's even more romantic and classic if you're surrounded by interesting characters and people you actually learn from and not basically, you know, office assholes.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was, at least when I was there, it was a pretty cool makeup of people.
Mm-hmm. Okay, just like anybody that really, apart from your mom, any other people that you picked up stuff from?
You know, not really. I mean, I was just a kid, so I was kind of, I was sitting at a desk and draw. I would draw all over the blotter, like those big calendars on the desk. I wonder if people still have those. You know what I'm talking about. The big calendar, it would have, like, the black plastic triangles in the corner it would, like, slide into.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so I would draw all over that and just pop my head up every now and then and see if anybody had anything in the basket. Okay.
But I'm just saying, okay, you had my wife. What about the dad part from, of course, you two seeing movies and everything? What did the dad do?
Dad was in real estate.
Ah, dude.
My parents were high school teachers when they met. They were both English teachers.
Okay.
And then dad was in real estate. Yeah. I grew up in the suburbs, and he worked in a model home that was at the front of the neighborhood. I don't know why that's funny to me. It's just kind of funny. It feels so like if you saw it in the movie, it would seem cheap, right? Like his job's a real estate agent, so he works selling homes in the neighborhood he works in.
Yeah.
It's like a, yeah, I don't know.
I was gonna say it sounds like a
Wes Anderson movie, but like I hate the idea. I like saying something sounds like a Wes Anderson movie is like kind of obnoxious.
Yeah, but as you said, he sold homes in where he worked. And when he got, where you guys lived in a model home?
No, we weren't the the Blutes in Arrested Development. Yeah. But there's like in the suburbs, in like new suburban neighborhoods, there's often at the entrance to the neighborhood there's a home, it's a model home.
Mm-hmm.
So like, if you want to go check out the neighborhood, first you'll stop at this model home, and there'll be an agent there who like works. There's like an office in the front, and then you walk, you know, and then he can show you the house, and then you can drive you around the neighborhood. And that's where he works.
Alright, so, yeah, that was, I just wanted to get into, like, also, I'm sure Hannah and Hannah and Her Sister wasn't the only film you saw at the Old Man. I mean, was that kind of like an old, a reoccurring thing that you and the dad would catch? Or even, would it be you and the mom, or would it be a family gathering at the movies with you, with the Gielgud family?
They were both, I remember my childhood as having a lot of movies in it. I remember when we moved down to Charlotte, with the moving truck was a day late, so we didn't, we got to where the house that we were moving to, and we didn't have any stuff, we didn't have anything, there was nothing to, you know, you think, when you move, you think like, okay, now we're going to go home, you know, there's going to be a ton of work to do. So we got there and there was nothing to do, so we went to see Back to the Future.
Oh, yes.
And I think that kind of introduced to me the idea that when you have, as soon as you're freed of obligations, the first thing you do is check the movie listings.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, yeah, and Woody Allen movies, I don't know, I played against Sam, like, that's probably like the hardest I've ever seen my dad laugh.
Mm-hmm.
And that's still like, I still think that's one of the funniest movies ever made.
Yeah. I mean, what kind of movie theater was happening for y'all at that time? It was the mid-80s, in the 80s, so I'm guessing it was the nearby shopping mall multiplex.
Right? Yeah, it was probably like, I don't remember movie theaters and shopping malls until a lot later for me. I know that's like an iconic sort of stereotypical thing, but it always seems sort of exotic to me for some reason. Maybe I just happened to grow up around malls that didn't have movie theaters.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe like the mall movie theater seemed a place where like people were just hanging out.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like they didn't seem like temples of movie going. Like was like the local movie theater that had like six screens and you had to drive there and park there just to go to the movie. Right?
Oh, yeah.
Like that was more appealing to me. Like I'm just thinking about this now. I hadn't thought about this before, but I think it would never have occurred to me to go to the mall to see a movie. Now when I go see my parents, there's a big outlet mall. That's where we go to the movies. There's like a 25 screen house by the huge outlet mall.
Well, I mean, I remember talking about this with another person on the show, and because I grew up in Houston, and they would, you know, when you go to theaters, it, you know, they would have the, you know, you go to theaters and it would usually be built inside a shopping mall. And
right.
It'd be just like you skip over to, you know, the Walden Books and then the Wyatt's Cafeteria, and then there would be the 2-3 theaters and whatnot. And so just I just assume that you at that, you know, at many other malls around America, they would have, especially back during that time, that the movie theaters would be built inside shopping malls. I mean, it's not like now where it's just, you know, 20, 30s, like there's movie theaters that just its own island, you know, just 20, 30
right.
screens going on there. Just like this back in those good old days when, you know, at the least there'd be like a 5-6 multiplex inside of a shopping mall. So I was just thinking whether that was the same experience for you.
Yeah, it's like that idea of that little 3 or 4 screen movie theater in a mall is kind of quaint. It feels kind of quaint now, but like the whole idea of a shopping mall is kind of quaint now. Like,
yeah.
I went to visit a friend in Chapel Hill a year or two ago and ended up at the mall, and it was deserted.
Hey, which mall was this?
If I heard the name, I don't remember. There is a movie theater there.
first off, I've been here for 9 years. I didn't know there was a shopping mall in Chapel Hill, so that's one thing. And
it wasn't in Chapel Hill, it was in Durham.
Oh, well, yeah, Durham. I think I know which one you're talking about. Is it Northgate?
Yeah.
Yeah, so yeah, that's, I was thinking, just, like, there's one, just one kind of sad mall in the area that I know of, and that one is Northgate. And I know which theater you're talking about, that, and I know, and that's that theater is actually located right next to the mall. And so, but, I mean, yeah, but that's the thing, like, well, we have to also establish that there's two main malls in Durham. One is Northgate, and the other one is South Point, and a lot more people go to South Point, which may explain why Northgate looks sad, because everybody is at South Point, because South Point has...
Okay.
South Point has the bigger movie theaters with an IMAX, or Limax, or whatever you want to call it, but just, yeah, that they got the bigger movie theater, they got the bigger Barnes & Noble, they got the Apple Store, they got all that stuff, and it's, yeah, so a lot more people go to that one, so, and Northgate is, as I like to call it, the other mall, so.
Right, yeah, there's always that in Charlotte, too, there was always, like, that other weird mall, or the one in Raleigh was always, So in Raleigh, there's the Crabtree Mall, right? Like, that's the prestigious one. And then that other one, what's the other one? Yeah. It's over there. It's kind of like on the way to the Colony Theater.
On the way, oh, North Hills?
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, North Hills. That's the one, yeah, down on near Six Forks.
Yeah. I lived in Raleigh for like 6 years. I don't think I ever went in that one. It always just looked like... It always just looked like, is it like the sun never shined on that mall?
I go there all the time because North Hills has the movie theater there. People frequent that place. I think it's more like a scattered residence. I mean, because that North Hills got all everything. They got the hotel. They got all the damn. Restaurants, and of course, got the movie theater out front, and there's a Total Wine. So, I mean, the funny thing is, like, we've gone to things where we don't live in a shopping mall type of culture anymore. Like, nothing really closed in as more. It's like it's all out and about, you know, just like we're these multi-layered strip malls, in a sense.
Yeah.
And it's that's what I know. That's basically what caught my eye the first time I I lived down here. It was just like, oh, just seems to be. I'm living in downtown Raleigh, and then you go outside downtown Raleigh, and there is all the different types of homes, and of course the strip malls that are connected right next to it. And just like, it just seems to be a burgeoning area where it's just like everything is either these big neighborhoods with the major homes and also the malls to go along with the neighborhood. So,
when do we start? Like, there's a mall that like serves that population. It's very clear. Like,
yeah.
Like these establishments are here for this set of people.
Yeah. It's like, when did we start talking about malls? I just realized, holy shit.
I'm curious about it now, because malls were, I was kind of like malls when I was a kid.
Well, yeah, I like malls as a kid, too. It's just, you know, first off, it's hard for me to, I'm talking, even like the malls that are around now, I don't know if I'm too damn tired to go to malls anymore, because I'm old. I'm 36, but I'm just like, how old are you, man?
I'm 34.
34, isn't it? I'm just old. And plus, it's just like, oh, jeez. Plus, malls is more like a teenager's thing. And all these teenagers that are around now, I mean, I just can't, especially all the teenage girls running around dressing up in half clothing and shit like that. I feel like looking at them.
We don't really have the mall and the classic kind of suburban center up here, so I'm probably, they've kind of gotten like a mythic quality in my mind.
Yeah, well,
it's always dispelled pretty quickly once I actually go to one.
Yeah, I'll go Mars, because, yeah, just looking at the girls, I feel like I might, I'm afraid to catch an R. Kelly case or anything like that, I tend to go be near my, you know, most, you know, first of all, I haven't shopped for clothing in years, so I just wear the same shit over and over again until it's just out, but just, I don't know, maybe one day I'll go back to some mall and just and try to take in the mall experience, but not now.
You gotta do it like as an anthropologist or something.
Yeah. I mean, when the last time you was in a mall?
I was in a mall. I went to an outlet mall near Niagara Falls a couple months ago.
Niagara Falls? How was that?
It was pretty, the mall itself was pretty lively, and there was a great mural out front on the side of the, mall that had like a, that looked like, Niagara Falls, and it had a really good trompe l'oeil thing happening, like it looked like you could really look into it for a second.
Alright, well that's interesting. I didn't know Niagara Falls had malls, but, you know, that's, Okay, so I guess we could stop the mall chunk of this podcast and kind of go into when you were in college and you were studying film and everything. And was it kind of like, because I know exactly if it was your intention to write about film or do something in film. I mean, what were you looking to become once you got that diploma and got out of there?
Well, I was making shorts when I was in college, with my friend Robert Green, who he's now making documentaries. And I was also really interested in film criticism. I was really, I really enjoyed writing about movies. We'd actually like the little sect of guys who were taking these film courses with like Joe and Jim and Maria would actually like read each other's papers. And I was interested in the kind of like the Godard model of, you know, like filmmaking as criticism. Kind of like where those two worlds just overlap and become the same thing. The idea that like filmmaking is commentary about film itself. I got really interested in that. Kind of what you're asking.
Well, mostly about just what you were was looking to do. I don't know if it was kind of like you're kind of talking about what got you into wanting to do it, but like just like how was it afterwards when you graduated? I mean, was it kind of like a thing where you wanted to? You say you stayed in Raleigh, and you started writing for the Independent, and you were doing more. I mean, was it you wanted to do film, but you started doing gallery stuff? So I just wanted to see how that whole thing went.
Yeah, I made a couple short movies I was never really that happy with them.
Well, what were they about?
They were pretty experimental. Mm-hmm. They didn't have. At least one of them had no dialogue. Those memories aren't that pleasant.
What was unpleasant about them? I mean, was it kind of the process of making the films, or just?
Yeah, I just couldn't get the hang of it. Like I just couldn't. There's a lot of qualities that it takes to be a filmmaker that. They're not glamorous, they're not sexy qualities, like you have to be very well organized, you have to great work ethic, you have to be, you have to like get people together on time, you have to like, there's a lot of planning involved, the art making element of filmmaking comes like after you've gotten a ton of things figured out.
Yeah.
And I could just never prioritize that stuff, and then, The process after you've shot everything is like that's the most thankless thing in the world. I mean, that's like a certain level of hell. It's just like logging footage, and like naming clips, and then figuring, you know, like going through take after take, figuring out which take is best, figuring out which take, you know, like which shot matches another shot. I'm sure for some people that is rewarding because they're so inside of the process. It took me a long time to figure out that like that process was so thankless to me that I was probably not in the right place.
Well, it's just interesting just you talking about it because, I mean, was it a whole thing where just, because you mentioned how to say it's thankless, I mean, in the sense that you didn't think that what you were doing would be given any credit, or just the whole idea of just rounding up and editing, you know, the whole post-production process of making a film.
Well, like, if you compare it to, like, there's a couple comparisons you can make, right? Like, somebody could love movies, right? But if you make a living as a movie critic, which I don't, but, like, if you make a living as a movie critic, it involves going to tons and tons and tons of movies.
Yeah.
A lot of them will never come out. Like, a lot of them you're going to see, and you're never going to write about them. No one's ever going to see them. A lot of the movies you're writing about, it's obligatory. They're movies that you're kind of like, you're having to find something to say about them. You don't really have anything to say about them, but you need to figure out some intelligent way, some interesting way of talking about this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's context or whatever. My point is just that, like, there's a process to movie critics. Now, to me, that's, like, totally enjoyable. The idea of, like, spending day after day after day, like, seeing tons and tons of movies, even though a lot of them are pretty cruddy. To some people, that just sounds awful. But to me, there's just something about that process and where it leads that, like, that's attractive to me. Like, I like that. Mm. Or, like drawing. Like, if you're doing a detailed drawing, that's going to take a lot. Like, there's going to be hours and hours that go into it that are just, like, you're just, like, cross-hatching. You're, like, you're just making line after line after line, and then making another line after line after line, so it's, like, starts to take shape. It's just process, right?
Mm.
Like, I'm at home inside of that. Like, that feels good to me.
Yeah.
So I think that, like, when you're figuring out what you want to do, if the process of it, like, if the stuff that's not fun needs to feel fun. The stuff that's not fun to other people needs to feel fun to you.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, I mean, just, you just wanted to find something that would be appealing to you and as rewarding to you, and so I mean, would, even though you didn't find that when you're doing filmmaking, I mean, when did it start becoming that aspect where you started finding things that were rewarding to you as well as something that you can make money off of?
Well, I still haven't figured out any money off of anything, but you know, here and now, pick up a little bit. Well, I kind of talked about drawing. I started taking drawing seriously a few years ago, and that's kind of just what I just described. I found that was happening. Like, just figuring things out felt really good. Even not figuring things, like, I never felt like I was wasting time when I was making movies. Like, if I was like logging footage or just like, you know, like going through take after take after take, it just felt like, when will this be over, you know?
Yeah.
Just checking the clock constantly. And when I'm drawing it, I don't feel that way. You know, I feel mostly, unless I'm working on like a tight deadline or something, but like mostly I feel pretty relaxed. I feel pretty good about what I'm doing. I feel at home.
Yeah. Well, that's what I wanted to know a lot about is the illustrative side of your life, because, and you said you took that seriously a few years ago. I'm trying to see just where did the idea, the sense of you wanting to do drawings and illustrations come from? Because just like it seems like you have already this classical sense of being an illustrator about you. Just like I find hard to believe that this just happened overnight.
Yeah, I mean, I would do comics in college, like, just, like, sitting in class, I would draw comics, and friends would really like them. The thing that I think, maybe, about that is that, again, it's, like, because it kind of came naturally to me, I undervalued it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, like,
tell you, hey, you should take this seriously, because obviously you appear to have a knack for it?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, a lot. You know, often my friend Jonathan in college, Robert Green, who I mentioned, he's making movies now. My girlfriend, who I've been with for a while now, for years, really supportive. So, you know, my parents were always like, my parents always thought that it was something I should really go after. I don't know why I fought it for a really long time. I don't know why. I didn't know I was fighting it, but.
You didn't know you'd find it. Well, because, like, you said something came natural. And also, from what I gather from what you do, I mean, and I was actually about to ask you the issue of whether or not you, because looking at the various stuff you've done online with your drawings, people would come to describe them as doodles. And I don't know if that's something to be, if you deem that as offensive.
No, I don't really play that game. The same way I'd rather call movies and films, and I don't use the word cinema unless I absolutely have to. I think it's good to, I think it's better to use playful terms when you talk about stuff like that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, because that's what I was thinking, because a lot of your illustrations would be seen as doodles, and even something you would consider what you would do as doodles, and you would almost see that as like it wouldn't be something that would be productive or lucrative for you in the long run.
Right. It's hard to imagine when you, totally.
Well, just seeing were there any influences, because looking at your stuff, I don't want to be the, asshole that says, this reminds me a lot of R. Crumb and everything, but it does have, like, some Crumb-esque things about it, even just,
if you ask any basketball player now, like, who's the guy, it's Michael Jordan. I mean, like, yeah. Crumb was, it's like everyone who came after that, that's who you grew up on,
Yeah, I mean, was he an influence on you?
What's that?
Was he an influence on you?
Yeah, totally. I mean, he's still like, as far as comics go, I mean, he's still the gold standard, I think. Mm-hmm. There's something to do with Pico, I think, there's something about, like, when Crumb is given free rein, subject-wise, especially when it's autobiographical, I think it can get a little less dynamic. But when he's telling Picard stories, there's something about, like, he has to have this fidelity to this sort of blue-collar, observational sort of storytelling that brings him down to earth and gives the drawing some earthiness.
Yeah.
And so to me, that collaboration is just like, you can't beat it.
Yeah. I mean, is there any other influences that you've had in your work?
It's everybody you expect. I mean, like, Raymond Pettibon, Myra Coleman, Leanne Chapin, whose work my girlfriend put me on to a few years ago. I think it's all a bit, I think it's all, like, evident in the work. Carl Schultz, that stuff's all there. The thing about drawing, though, is that, like, I feel like you can only do what you're capable of doing, because there's a certain way your hand wants to move and wants to make shapes that it's always gonna just look like you.
Yeah.
So I try not to escape influence the same way that you don't want to copy stuff. Does that make sense?
You kind of embrace it and try to make it your own.
Yeah, I guess what I mean is, like, I don't know how hard you have to try to make it, I think it's always gonna come out that way.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's funny how just, because there is, this whole side of you where you do a lot of, drawings, illustrations, to the point where you live in Brooklyn, and it seems that you have... it's interesting you say that you haven't exactly figured out how to make a career or money off it, because it seems that a lot of people calling you to do stuff, like you just mentioned, BAM Cinematheque calls you to do on things, and just as I was reading that your illustrations were in... illustrations of literary authors, of course, in this store called In God We Trust in Brooklyn. Those illustrations are still up there, right?
They might be. I haven't been in there a while, but I think so. Yeah.
Yeah, because I believe they were calling you to when they would have some sort of bizarre, like those bizarre street fair type of deals. You would be there.
I did that a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The idea was to try to do, to sell stuff, but also to do, portraits.
Yeah.
But that was so weird to me. I would always rather you ask me to draw some, baseball player or something than, draw you. Occasionally people would want themselves drawn, and I would ask them if I could just take their picture with the computer and then draw from the picture, because I couldn't do this anymore. Somebody sat down, I looked at them and draw. It just felt too weird.
Also, I believe you, it's interesting you just said that people asked you to draw them, because didn't you do illustrations for a wedding?
Yeah. This woman who, she actually wrote a piece about me, because she saw myself in God We Trust. And she wrote for an online magazine, and then when she got married, she got me to do illustrations for their wedding invitations. So that was pretty fun.
Yeah, I've never really heard of people, especially for a wedding, calling somebody, "Hey, could you do some illustrations?" I mean, that didn't strike you as a peculiar thing.
Now that you mention it, yeah, I guess it's unique. But it seems like a natural fit. I mean, it seems better than selecting a template from some website.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It seems more natural to me to want to do that.
And you also do this.
I don't know. Maybe the whole wedding industry is something I need to tap. Maybe that's how I'll finally be able to quit a day job.
Well, yeah. Just if there's anybody out there. Well, you can tell people, hey, I'd also do weddings. But
like a lounge singer or something.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, but you also do this thing, which I'm also trying to if I'm correct, it is a very interesting thing. There's this website called Biographile, and you review books, but you also do illustrations of scenes from the book in your posts.
Yeah, this woman Kara, who I knew because she worked at BAM briefly, started working for that site, and the idea was to try to bring some illustrations onto the site. And then the text, writing the copy, actually came later when we realized. Because they needed, just because of the format of the site, they need to have some kind of, just a 200-300 word essay about them. I wouldn't call them reviews, really. The ones that I do, they're more just kind of to give you some sense of what the book is like, and then the editorial content is more than the illustrations themselves.
Yeah. I mean, I have a feeling you're a big reader.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, coming from the literary authors that you drew for the In God We Trust and stuff like that. So just know it's kind of interesting. Just you coming about with the doing a lot of literary related things, and just is that something you would hope to? That would be something you hope to do one day.
What do you mean?
Well, just, I don't do a combination. I mean, I don't know how much of level of literary influence you have, but just like seeing how you could, or just putting your illustrations in book form.
Well, yeah, I want to do, I don't know how literary this is, but I'm going to work with this guy, a friend of mine named Jeff Jansen, and we're going to try to do, I don't know if you've seen, I've been doing drawings of a Knicks player every time the Knicks have won this year.
Oh, yeah, I've seen those.
And we're going to try to do a book with his text where he'll write about kind of whatever he wants, and we'll pair him with the drawings, and we'll try to put out a book, hopefully before the playoffs are over. We'll try to like, kind of just self-publish a book of, like a Knicks book, I guess.
Yeah. Well, it's so interesting you're doing all these other things that kind of like one of the initial reasons why I want to talk to you, of course, is because you and I kind of, in a sense, still do film reviews for the indie. And because, like, you've been doing them, let's say, what was it, since, when did Cheshire leave? Because you had that movie Midway. I think that finally came out in, 2008?
Was that his movie?
Yeah. And
he left to make that, right?
Well, no, he was making it, and while he was making it, he was reviewing stuff. But that was kind of like his big send-off in a way, because, you know, he made the movie, he got it released here in the Triangle, and when he got it released here, you just say, like, you know what, I'm a filmmaker now, so fuck you. And just basically, left the indie actually to write for Raleigh Metro, so I don't know if he's still doing that. But, yeah, he left the indie, and then I'm trying to remember when exactly you come into the picture, because I started seeing your byline.
Yeah, I don't know, maybe 4 years ago? Does that sound right?
Yeah. Yeah, because it's funny because I was looking on your, because you have a blog, a review blog. I mean, is that how it kind of started? Because you started reviewing on your blog, and I think David saw that.
Oh, yeah, before I blogged, I actually was just writing. I was just, like, ghosting movies, and I would write something in a Microsoft Word document and just email it to people.
Really? Wow! Like
and
that.
And David ended up on my list somehow, and then I eventually moved him as it became like easier. There were, you know, like there was proliferation of like these blog platforms you could use, and this was even before it was common for them to be free. So like I got this like $5 a month one and started posting reviews online. Mm-hmm. And then I guess I kind of like it just kind of refamiliarized. Fell
off with my stuff, and so I guess I was maybe at the forefront. You know, I was like already on his mind when he was looking for somebody new.
I guess. I never really asked him.
Well, like I said, like at the beginning, you're down there in New York and Brooklyn, so it's kind of, and since Godfrey was in New York as well, kind of like it just seemed to be a logical thing to get somebody from New York to, you know, just in case, you know, we don't get a lot of screenings of movies. Oh, there's a guy up in New York who can, and the movie's probably already playing there already, so.
Well, right, for the art house stuff, yeah, and then occasionally there'll be a screening up here. Like, I'm going to go see, you guys aren't getting a screening of Great Gatsby, so I'm going to go see that tomorrow night so we can get something online about it.
Oh, you bastard. But, yeah.
why are you excited about that?
Not really. That's another thing I want to talk to you about, because I don't know exactly how enthused you are when it comes to reviewing stuff, because it does seem like, especially, I don't know if you want to be put in the same boat as I, but the indie has a stable of film writers, a lot of film writers, and you know, some are more hungry than others to get their words out there in print, and it's just like, I'm not as hungry as I used to be. Yeah.
Were you the Daily guy at the NNL for a while?
Yeah, I was.
Okay. Yeah.
And And I know how it is with you. I mean, because when the year-end stuff happened last year, I was surprised that you weren't involved in any of that.
I was absent from the year-end stuff because, you know, it's a bummer to say it, but like even A.O. Scott, right, says like I didn't see as many movies this year as I did last year. I'm definitely missing a lot of stuff from time to the year. Like I know that's like a cliche of year-end film criticism, right? But like I really didn't see that much last year, I had already given the movie that I really want to talk about from the year. I'd already gotten to write about. I wrote about Paperboy, which just blew me away. I just loved it. Mm-hmm. So I already got a chance to like give this rave review to the movie that I thought didn't get enough attention that year. So I just thought I'd be making stuff up if I tried to do a year end piece.
Well, I mean, again, getting into just why you didn't see a lot of movies last year. I mean, was it just like you didn't have time, or just nothing was really catching your eye?
I think it has to do with what you were saying. I mean, it's a hunger factor. You know, it's like. I used to go to movies every day, sometimes twice a day. I'd see like at least 5 movies a week. It's just not the same anymore. And I guess that's probably one of the worst things about, the sort of nosedive that film criticism is taking as far as being able to make a living off of it is that idea that if you hustle hard enough, you know, if you go to movies enough, if you become as much of a fixture of that world as you can, that you can make at least maybe like a part-time job out of it. You know what I mean? So I feel like there's a motivation missing there as you get older. When you're younger, like as you get older, though, you need to spend time on things that you might be able to make a buck off of. You know?
Yeah.
Or that become like a sort of stable, regular part of your life.
Yeah.
It seems like there's less and less of a reason, except for pure passion, to like go to movies constantly.
Well, it's interesting. Here you say that, because I kind of feel that same way, but there's like several other factors that play into it, because I'm down here in Raleigh, and I don't know if you know this about Raleigh, when it comes to movies, publicists and distributors don't really think of this part of the country as lucrative for them. They all think we're all up in the woods, wearing overalls and stuff, so they don't feel, even though we got all these art house theaters and all these multiplexes, we're still like a second, third tier market. And so it's very difficult not only to get movies down here, like, because Fella Raff was emailing me today about Upstream Color and whether or not that was going to play down here. And I didn't know, because nobody knew exactly and if it was coming down here or not. And not only get films down here, but also get screenings of film. You just said there's not a screening of The Great Gatsby here, so it's playing over there. So we can't even get screenings of movies in time. And you have to rely on the whim of film publicists, because they're the ones who dole out these screenings in the first place, and you don't know whether or not they're going to screen movies here, because they always say, oh, it's, you know, they decided not to screen down here. Like, who the hell decided not to? There's film critics down here too, and so you don't know if any of these, you'll see any of these movies in time to do reviews. I would figure it would be a very different thing for you, because like I said, you're in New York, and of course all the movies play there first, and you get screenings of movies before anybody else does. So you have that advantage, like, of having all that, and so it would be much easier for you to review a lot more films. Just like I would think, you know, since you are in New York and you have all these advantages, that you would have the upper hand on all of us. And
I didn't know it was competition, but
It's a competition now. But that's a whole other thing. But just like, yeah, but I would just think, like, because you have all these things at your disposal, that, you know, that you would want to consider doing more and writing more.
Well, I don't know. I mean, don't you think it's better? I mean, like, I think it's better for the independent if more of the writing comes from you guys. Like, I think for a paper that's serving an area, there's something, there's a value in publishing work by people who actually live there. And I think that that's why, you know, like, Gossy Central had a connection. You know, like, he's from there. Right? Is he from there or just live there?
Yeah, he's from there.
I used to write for you guys when I lived there, so there's a connection there. But, like, I think it would be kind of weird if all of a sudden they tried to, like, dominate the film pages there. You know what I mean?
Well, but that's the thing, because, and even though, you know, you're not the only person who feels that way, that it there should be more of a regional voice when it comes to film reviews. Not a lot of the publicists, not a lot of people who work in the film industry in general feels that way. Just like if. Especially in the print media, because I got laid off from that, so therefore
right.
it doesn't really matter that much that there should be a local film critic. Like people, you know, the people feel that doesn't really matter, so they can get wire reviews, and they can get somebody from New York to review, or somebody from LA to review or write about this film or whatever. So it is unfortunate that, you know, you are not the first person to talk about how it would be much preferable to have local people write about film. You know, it's you know, not a lot of people, you know, not a lot of other people, but a lot more people in higher, in higher offices feel that way.
Yeah. Well, it's funny that we bring it up, because I just read your review of Give Me the Loop.
Really?
When you talked a lot about New York.
Yeah.
I was reading it saying, this should have been mine.
Okay. I'm sorry about that. Well, the funny thing is, like, one of the main reasons I got it, because I'm pretty sure none of y'all knew about it. I mean,
the movie itself?
Yeah, well, I should say, did you know a lot about it when it was, because I
mean, I had heard about it, yeah, the milieu is interesting to me, so, like, I had watched the preview, I was just kidding about how it should have been mine. I liked your review, I thought it was cool that you talked about it in the context of New York and sort of, like, that idea of the 20 years ago New York, or probably even more, that was dangerous and different.
Yeah.
Than New York now. I thought you were pretty spot on. The only thing I thought you missed the mark on was you said there was a war between Mets and Yankees fans, and I don't know if that's ever been true.
Well, I was going by the movie, because it's kind of like, that was kind of,
Oh, right, because it had something to do with the Mets, right? Like, they go to City Field, they want to tag something in City Field, right?
Yeah, and, you know, they would talk with, you know, because they're talking about going out with the Mets, and they would talk to people and say, you know, fuck you, I'm a Yankees fan, and all that stuff. And that I was just going from the
Mets. Oh, okay,
yeah. Well, that was a funny thing, because, like, I was hoping, you know, when you started talking about that, I'm just like, you know, you mentioned Give Me a Loot, and considering you live down there in New York, I'm just like, gosh. I was just even thinking, like, oh, shit, would I screw up? Because even though I don't live in New York, I've been in New York a couple of times, but it's just... I admired the film in that sense, that it did give people a sense of New York, and just in knowing a lot about New York, it just kind of brought this a sense of I don't know, the combination of accuracy and posterity about just what the, you know, what the that area is and what it means to people. And so in me writing about that, I really wanted to bring that point across, and hopefully that, you know, people who are in New York or from New York would read that review and hopefully, you know, realize I, you know, just would not take offense to any of it.
No. I'm a big Mets fan, and I just think the Yankees fans never care about us.
I think it's a lot of, mostly about that. Just like this I don't know if it's a war rival or something, but you do get a sense that, you know, like I said, you know, when they were talking like you like the Mets and they say fuck you Yankees, there is that sense of dismissal. So maybe I should have said the dismissal Yankees fans have for Mets fans and all that. So
yeah. Well, speaking of dismissal, I think I might have to ask to be dismissed. I think I gotta move on to the next thing.
Okay. Well, before you go off, and I got a lot of things to do. Usually at this point in the podcast, when we close things out, I tell the guests, you know, whether to drop some other things people can find them online, the Twitter, the blogs, if you're on Pinterest. I know your artwork is on Etsy and everything, so just tell people where they can find you online.
Well, you can go to NathanGelder.com. That's a pretty good jumping off point for everything. I use my last name, Gelder, for Twitter and Instagram, and you can see I put a lot of drawings on Instagram, so that's a good place to check those out.
Yeah, and your film review blog is still up there, New York Film Review.
I should update it a little bit, but every time I update it, I'm just linking to what I wrote on the Independent, so I think everybody just needs to make sure they're following the Independent feeds.
Yeah, so, okay. Yeah, all right. So, yeah, and they can also find you in the Independent Weekly. So this was well for you, sir?
Yeah, just fine.
All right, well, thank you very much. Just thank you for everything. But let me close this out real quickly. As always, this is Craig D. Lindsay saying, I have had good time since 1997, which is, like, the first time I was ever in New York and had a good time. I saw Scream 2 and a whole other stuff. I'll get that into that one of these days. But,